This is Farmer D bringing you season two of the Citizen Farmers Podcast, where we are reimagining community through interviews with citizen farmers throughout the country. This season, our goal is to inspire, teach, and connect you to the projects, people, and places that are changing the way we live through regenerative agriculture, conservation, and community development. Are you ready to build a healthier, more connected world? Let's get started. This is Farmer D with the Citizen Farmers Podcast, Season 2, Reimagining Communities. Today, I'm with Clayton Garrett of Agmenity, based in Houston, Texas. How you doing, Clayton?
Good. How are you, D?
I'm good. I'm really good. I'm excited to chat with you. So Clayton and I have known each other for several years now. We got to know each other initially when you came on board at Harvest Green with Johnson Development Company to implement the farm that we helped design years ago in collaboration with SWA. But we didn't really first meet in person, I don't think, until the ULI retreat at Coastal Roots Farm, right?
I think that's right. Yeah, we were trying to reimagine where we had connected. You know, we saw a beautiful plan for Harvest Green and we're like, how do we do this? You know, and then who is this person who created this plan? We'd like to talk to them. I think we had a couple phone calls and then we had a great invite from you to come out to San Diego to put together a really beautiful program that we still talk about, the ULI AgriHood document. I think that you were really the big effort. How did that come to be? Can you give me a little insight into that?
You know, it's really cool to see how things have evolved in this movement, right? And one of the things that I noticed that inspired me to kind of initiate that whole AgriHood study with ULI was multiple things. But the main thing is there's so many of these projects popping up around the country. And, you know, we had our hand in a number of them. And you always worry, right? You put all this effort into designing something and then you hand it off and you just pray that, like, you know, it's going to be executed well and that you can be proud of what you helped kind of design. And so a lot of the farms and communities, AgriHoods around the country are all trying to figure it out. And so I thought, well, how can we all figure it out together, right? And so that was kind of what inspired this initiative to bring everyone together and share best practices and kind of lessons learned and figure out how we can work more closely as a group, as a collective, as a field, to both support each other and help each project be more successful, or at least avoid some of the pitfalls that some of the projects have experienced, and also how to, like, really promote the concept and share the ideas and the values and the benefits more broadly to the development community, the investment community. Yeah, that was part of the inspiration. I could talk a lot more about it, but I was so excited that when I started talking to you and Scott, your partner there, and feeling like the farm was in really good hands. And then we've had a great relationship over the last several years, just sharing stories and collaborating and figuring out how we can do this well and share some of those experiences, which is really what I want to talk to you about today.
Yeah, you know, some of those relationships that we met there have just continued on. I mean, lots of them, right, from a professional standpoint, but also just like imagining what this is, trying to understand from everybody's perspective in different places. You know, farming is so place specific and design is very place specific. How we can understand some of the patterns that are happening and some of the issues and problems. And I know we can kind of sort through some of those later on in our conversation, but it's, you know, we actually on this last week, and we came in touch with a bunch of folks related to that conference. And then the other thing I think is so fascinating about getting just people together, you know, we obviously can't do that really very well right now, but is just the sort of the lens that you take away from that experience. So there's a lot of information that we just kind of started to reframe and relook at some of the things we were doing just based on other people's experience. And that doesn't happen unless you kind of have some people in the room together, you know, ideas bouncing off each other. And you were such a great host. So we've always appreciated that sort of energy and effort.
Thanks. No, it's, you know, it's interesting because I think this, I've always found in farming, there was always one of the things that drew me into farming in the early days was how supportive the other farmers, the elders in the community were when I was coming in as like a young farmer trying to figure it out. You know, it's easy to think about this through a lens of competition. And, you know, there's not a lot of us out there that do what we do. And I think initially when we, part of it is when you get together and you get to know each other and appreciate kind of where you're coming from, you build relationships and build friendships. And then you also start to build trust. And those are important ingredients to be able to collaborate. I've been excited about building this relationship with you guys and figuring out how we can collaborate more to help each other be successful and ultimately help this movement be more successful. So one of the things that I also noticed, you know, that farming is hard as it is. You know, I think we've both had experiences trying to like run farming businesses. And so the idea of bringing a farm into a community in some ways makes it even harder because you're farming in kind of in a fishbowl, so to speak. You're farming right in a neighborhood. But at the same time, it creates these synergies where people can engage with the farm and you can engage with community and build community and build, again, those relationships with people that start to build trust and loyalty and connectivity. Part of the, I think, inspiration behind the report with ULI, but more broadly, the idea of just trying to figure out how to farm in community has really, for me, been a long journey of trying to figure out how to make a viable model for diversified, you know, regenerative, organic, biodynamic farming that is really about not just growing nutrient-dense food for people, you know, locally, but also about connecting people to the farm and the food and building community around that. So I know we share a tagline, cultivating community, growing community, right? We both share this kind of passion. And I'd love to hear, you know, from you, Clayton, just kind of what was the journey that got you into this work?
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to kind of share some thoughts here. And I think you nailed it on how difficult farming is and how challenging and how, you know, rewarding.
Especially when you get a snowpocalypse and you're... You guys had talk. It's hard enough as it is. Then you get crazy weather like you just had. My goodness.
Yeah, this, you know, as you know, so climate change is real, right? I think we can all agree on that. And one of the things we know, and from the farming experience, we know that what we're going to experience is more severity. So we're going to see some rising temperatures, but also more severe events. And in our 5-year farming in this model career, we've experienced Hurricane Harvey, which was devastating. I mean, 50 plus inches over course of a week. For farming, I think the farmers on the call or on the pod will appreciate this. You know, it was at a window, a transition window of our plants. So we were already pushing some of our plant health, but it hit in August 22nd. So for us, that's kind of a transition period, trying to have a viable farming business. And you're putting an extra pressure. Like our farms didn't flood necessarily. We had well-designed farms, but we had disease pressure and other sorts of seasonal pressure that really can be a big challenge. So we've had Hurricane Harvey. Then, of course, we had, you know, we've all lived through COVID, which puts an extra layer of pressure on distribution, health. We also saw a huge benefit of people being interested in resiliency and where food comes from. And, you know, there's just innumerable conversations that are happening around that. People just kind of are awake to it. Interestingly, like people have kind of moved on from that. It doesn't seem like we have the same level of interest. I'm sure other people are experiencing that too. And then post-COVID, you know, we had a deep, long freeze for us. So we lost some significant production on our farm. Again, we're kind of in a transitional window right here. And we're also a little bit, I think, aggressive on some of our production. So we tend to try to get things a little bit earlier. I think our model supports us being kind of first to market on some things, and also generate some of those excitements on, you know, whether it's tomatoes trying to get in the ground now. But, you know, our last freeze temperatures that kind of settled in were 1836, something like that. So we're experiencing a different model of farming. So I think there's an understanding of what's happening. So we're experiencing infrastructure challenges just like alongside the community members. Resilience is a conversation I think that's happening in lots of development places. I think when we talk to developers about what they're trying to do, I think everybody gets it, right? They're interested in it and they're just trying to understand how it works and can they take some of the risk off the table, right? In terms of understanding what it is they're trying to accomplish and costs involved and kind of all of those sort of things. And a lot of your and my conversation over the years have been like, how do we support that? You know, how do we support the farmers, right? So we are kind of, you know, I feel like my job is going to your citizen farmer model, you know, as a steward, but it's really a steward for the people, the farmers, right? And a little bit less the land in a way, because we don't own the land. Mm-hmm. But and so some of my stewardship is like, how do I create great jobs? How do I support people? You know, how do I get these developers to understand that this is something that we can accomplish in a very reasonable, manageable way? And, you know, it's not a big challenge. I mean, I think because people are so, the people who come to us are early adopters, right? So they're already excited. And it'll be interesting to see the evolution of sort of the market and people when we have to do a little more convincing to see, you know, to see what those projects look like, right? So I think it's an exciting time. We're seeing a tremendous amount of interest from the development community right now. I'm sure you are too.
It's encouraging, right, after being at this for 25 years now, trying to be, starting out being kind of this, like, you know, nut job, like, what are you talking about? And then as time has evolved and people's awareness about our food system and soil health and human health and the connections and local economies and all these things, sustainability, climate change, and COVID definitely highlighted a lot of the injustices and a lot of the issues around health and food supply chains and the value of community. And, you know, living here, it's funny because during COVID, I kind of potted up on an organic farm for 5 months in Northern California. And then now I'm potted up in Serenbee, ironically, where I started the farm so many years ago. And I'm looking out at a greenhouse, you know, full of leafy greens right now. And you see when COVID hit, what we've all been talking about for so long, so many of us have been promoting these ideas of sustainable community and local food. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, right, there can be lines down the street at the grocery. There can be empty shelves. There are vulnerabilities and there are reasons to be more resilient in your local community and more socially connected in community. It took a pandemic for people to, I think, see some of these things through a different light. Coming back for a minute, I'm curious to kind of get us, you know, you've got a really interesting background coming from a law background, right? Where was the fork in the road that kind of led you to agriculture and edible landscaping and ultimately to doing farms and communities?
Yeah. So I've been licensed in Texas for 12 plus years. You know, I think when I think about my legal experience, and I still love the law in lots of ways, right? But when I think about what I was trying to understand when I went to law school, was like I was trying to understand a little bit how the world worked. So trying to gain some wisdom, and then I eventually found a wisdom practice that was in the mindfulness space and meditation and some of those other things that now seems to be, you know, on the forefront of a lot of people's minds. And you know, through that, I understood that the legal practice was an advocacy practice, and I was representing small business, a lot of small businesses, and I really enjoyed, you know, helping them grow their businesses and, you know, advise them through some of their challenges. And I think I just fundamentally recognized that I wanted to do that. At the same time, my grandfather had in his late 50s and 60s started buying small farms in the panhandle of Texas where he lived. And he would buy kind of the out parcels and the strange little shaped farms. And he grew up very poor. Farming was romantic to him. I think owning land was romantic. And so my dad started doing the same thing in kind of his middle years. He started buying kind of smaller parcels, I think, to connect with his father. And so, you know, farming was always something I looked at as a way to kind of connect with that specific lineage, but also really understand what it is, you know, my family was obligated to do, which was take care of land, and take care of people. So, you know, I ran a commercial bakery. So after kind of my law practice, I got involved in some family businesses. I wanted to jump into business. And then I saw a couple of farming models that were interesting in the Austin area and some other places that were really doing some similar things. So direct to restaurant consumer. And with my kind of family farming background, I was really interested in kind of connecting those two things. So I joined a business partner. And so in 2015, SWA, the landscape architecture firm, brought us in to really advise on some edible plants. And I think they understood we had some capabilities that we weren't currently involved in. But my business partner had run small-scale organic farm for a number of years and advised. And we really were the people around town to talk to about, you know, edible landscaping. It's light commercial and those type of things that we'd been doing for a while. So they brought us in, and then, you know, the farm kind of program, they started talking about plants, and I think they were trying to get comfortable with us for a while, and then, you know, showed us a Farmer D plan for the farm and said, you know, we kind of like to do this. What do you guys think about it? And, you know, that was really our entry into the agri-hood world. I mean, this is kind of interesting. There wasn't a game plan to go along. So everybody was talking about a model. And when we looked at Serenbee, I think the development team went out there. And Serenbee is such a special and unique place and really a passion project for Steve, right? So I think from a development context, I don't know that other developers feel like that's a direct analogy they can make, right? it's a very unique model. It's a unique place. It's got a really impactful kind of presence already. But I think they were trying to, you know, understand like, how does that work in a suburban context in Houston, Texas? And that was our mission, was to kind of just sort through some of those things. I think also we were very fortunate and we had a great leader on the ground. He was incredibly inclusive and also, I think, very confident about the developer's ability to be successful, regardless of our farm ability to succeed or fail, right?
We're going to dig into that a little bit here around how it got structured. It's fun to think back. I think it was, I don't know, it might have been 2012 or so when I was invited to give a talk in Charlotte, North Carolina, at a ULI meeting. And the topic of the talk was kind of agriculture, the new golf, right? It was like, here's this concept of, you know, using farms instead of golf courses to build community and open green space. And Doug from Johnson came up to me and said, this is really fascinating. I'd love to get you out and look at some of our projects. At the time, they had, I think, like 7 or 8 different communities around Texas, so huge. And I remember spending 2 days, I think it was, with Doug, driving from project to project to project to project. And we looked at everyone of their 8 or so master plan communities around Houston and, you know, just kind of assessed, they were all already planned. And so it was kind of a like, could we integrate some kind of farm and community garden components into these already planned communities? And we came up with a couple of cool ideas and it was like retrofitting, you know, it was like, we could work in these kind of spaces that weren't, you know, that were kind of on power line edges or drill sites, or there were certain areas that were still potential for gardens and for small farms. And at the end of the day, he said, you know, look, we're doing a new project from scratch. Maybe the thing to do is to start thinking from day one. And let's do a project that really, rather than kind of an afterthought, let's make it kind of the forethought of like the kind of part of the inspiration behind the whole community. And that's where we had an opportunity to look at Harvest Green from the beginning. And that's why you have the farm at the front door. And when we identified there was this, you know, large tract that wasn't going to be developed, but it was a pretty prime agricultural land, you know, we said, look, this could be a really cool commercial kind of incubator farm above and beyond the community kind of amenity farm. And so there were a lot of really cool elements about it. And I think one of the takeaways for me was Johnson Development Company was very innovative. They were looking at these trends. They're one of the, you know, leading developers in the country of master plan communities. And, you know, while we could have retrofitted and incorporated things kind of as an afterthought, I think their idea to ultimately do something from scratch and really make it kind of a foundational element in the community, putting it right at the front door, connecting it with the school. You know, there's some really exciting aspects because of the location of the project and the farm in particular that we picked. It's so fun to see where these kind of, you know, a little talk, you know, a seed of an idea turns into a you know, one. I think Harvest Green was like one of the top communities in the country, right? For several years now.
Yeah.
And it activated and kind of inspired you guys to move in this direction where, you know, for that region in particular, so much opportunity in Texas. And now you've got, you know, years of experience from doing this project. So let's talk about some of the experiences that you've had to illustrate some of these ideas.
Yeah. You know, in our early days dealing with the development team, this was, you know, a big conversation, right? And there wasn't, again, a model that we could really feel comfortable looking at and say like, hey, this is, we can just do this. Or, and, you know, neither of us really had the expertise also to feel confident that some of the questions, you know, could be answered. One of the things that just made me chuckle was one of, you know, we had a lot of conversations around people stealing vegetables for, like, it just seemed like years, like a development person or a resident or somebody would be like, oh, what about people stealing vegetables? And we're like, hey, you know, like they have to go harvest the vegetables. And, you know, it's just not a problem. People kind of get it. Some of the human reference points, the structures that we do, the fences, the way people enter and engage with space and place, you know, that really informs some of these behaviors, right? It occasionally comes up a little bit, which I just think is amusing. From a development perspective, I think for the Harvest Green project, I think that the developer, you know, felt very confident about the theme. And whatever the theme ultimately ended up being, they were going to, you know, sell homes and they're going to, they had a great properties, great location, great school district. And, that, you know, I think they felt like they could lead with those things. And if it you know, by no means were they ever interested in any sort of greenwashing or, you know, not being authentic. That was never a conversation. And so that gave us some chances to kind of explore a little bit. So we initially started with, I think, a plan, and we started looking at your plan, and then landscape architects are like, how do we do this? And then we started building, you know, some basic numbers like, well, what does it take to do this? How many people? Kind of equipment, what kind of capital, you know, investments do we need to make? How do these things work? Where does this land live? And, you know, those are the questions I think that all developments have to answer for whatever, you know, style of amenity, I'll call it here. You know, and I think that's really what happened for us is that we started to understand people are not building golf courses anymore. They are heavily amenitizing their property. So, you know, that once we really understood, oh, this is an amenity, then that really helped some of our framework about the community building we can do or can't do, who's the ownership of things, the risk where things live. I mean, my legal background definitely informs my sort of opinion about some of these things. So at Harvest Green, we have a number of different stakeholders, right? We have a relationship with a developer. Sometimes that's financial, sometimes that's relational. The financial relationship we have is we have a consulting contract that lives throughout the project. So that consulting contract, you know, can get refined at certain times. And most of the time, like, we're in a mature stage of our farm, so there's almost zero consulting happening from us to the developer. Almost everything is happening is under our management contract. So we have a management contract with the entity who owns the land. And in this case, Harvest Green decided that, I think very smartly for a number of financial reasons, but they decided to put the farm into the homeowners association. It's what it's called in Texas. And the HOA was gifted a fully formed farm that the development put together and paid for and had capital expenses related to. And we have a management contract with the HOA to manage that farm. And under the management contract, we have some things that we are obligated to do. We don't really talk about things in the contractual form because it's really kind of, this is our, you know, the way we view it is like, we're stewards for this project and for the people on the ground. And we're going to take care of everything within our little boundaries, our borders. And we're going to also be very clear about where our boundaries end. So the farm is structured. It's a wholly owned entity. We have a management contract and we get paid a monthly fee. In our instance right now, we have a labor rate. So we basically have a pure labor expense to the HOA and all of our expenses are passed through. So, you know, if a pipe breaks on the farm, that's kind of an HOA expense. Yes, we're in control of the farm, but it's really about sort of the infrastructure in that case. And we have an obligation to maintain it and keep it well, much like a property management. I mean, really, I think the context here is a property management firm. So that's kind of the basic structure. In the early years, it seems like with folks, development folks, there was lots of conversations around developers wanting to create a space for farmers and give farmers a space, you know, to kind of co-locate next to their development, right? Which is like, hey, we'll give you this great farm and you can pay us $1 a year, you know, a nominal fee. And you can have all this infrastructure and, you know, it'll be great for everybody. And, we, you know, we can talk about all the reasons why that doesn't really work very well. But seemingly on its face, it seems like it would, right? The reason why we don't think it works is because we have not seen a model be successful over time in that space.
Do you know, is there any kind of covenant or protective clauses in the deed to the HOA that ensures that it stays in agriculture?
That's a great question. In our case, I don't exactly know where that lives.
Could the HOA at some point decide not to have it as a farm anymore and turn it into a dog park or whatever, right?
Well, it's complicated, right? So I suspect, and I haven't read through the deed restrictions of the entire parcel, but I suspect that this particular piece of parcel was designated as agriculture legally. And so there is a legal obligation for the HOA to uphold that. So they could be a different kind of farm, but really from a practical standpoint is that the developer is articulating to every resident, right? This is part of their sales tool, right? A marketing tool that they are going to have a farm and this is an agrihood. So I think that the development community needs to understand if they are saying that this is going to be an agrihood is really a new term. Well, it's trademarked by some friends of ours collectively in California, but it's still relatively an undefined term, but I think it's defined enough where if some change of use down the road, I think the residents would really have an uproar and have a legal they'd have a legal case to stand on. Farming is very broad, right? Right. So it's kind of problematic.
My conversations with Harvest Green early on about the HOA structure, you know, this was one of the areas that I really was very strong about, which is, you know, that's fine for the HOA because it's a nonprofit, can hold the farm, just making sure that they don't have decision-making power over how the farm is run, right? Maybe the contract, and that's about it.
Yeah.
So currently in the model now, are there HOA dues that go that are allocated towards the farm? Can you talk a little bit about kind of what your revenue streams are currently at Harvest Green?
Yeah. Every contract that we sign with the developer, you know, the developer has great outs, right? I mean, farming is so hard, but also the contracts, you know, there's a different leverage position that we have versus the developer. So I think from an HOA protection standpoint, I think the developers and the HOA council feels comfortable that it, you know, if we weren't performing, they could find another operator.
Right. Yeah.
You know, but the informal, the way I think about it informally is that we have to understand the value proposition that we have for the residents and broader community too, right? And make sure that our costs are in line with that proposition. So at Harvest Green, we have 4 full-time employees, so FTEs. And there's another 3 to 5 people that are connected to the project that do work for the project. Our numbers, the HOA numbers are public record. I mean, it's a public entity, but we were net 6%. Our farm expenditures were net 6% of the entire HOA budget. So the Harvest Green is right now 2,000 plus. I mean, the numbers are always hard, but it's about 2,000 home community, and they're selling final lots. And I think there's currently, you know, 1,500 homes occupied. So big community, I think like you mentioned, it was the top 50 fastest selling communities in the nation, past couple of years running, and, you know, really a lot of attention and interest in what it is that we're doing. So, but when you look at the net, you know, like we are cheaper than the pool. So we have 4 full-time employees, plus all this other activity, plus we're growing food for people, having resiliency conversations, doing all these things, and we're still cheaper than the pool. The landscape budget for just the property is, you know, 5 or 6 times what we are, right? So, you know, there's some economies of scale there that get to happen in these really large master plans that really make sense, I think fiscal sense, to have a farm component like we have here. And, you know, we're really proud of that number. We've been under budget every year, you know, something that we're also really proud of. And that takes a lot of effort, I think, on all sides. So we submit a budget to the HOA every year, right? And that budget includes basically the expense side, the things that we actually control, which is really expense side. And then all income goes to offset all those expenses. So I'm giving a net number, you know, so we have an expense side and then we have an income side, and all the income goes back to the HOA to support our activity. HOAs are not in the business of making money, right? So if we ever get to a place where the farm is, you know, some amazing revenue generating tool, you know, we'll just increase the expenses. And really what that expense is community programming and all these other things. What I think our net number actually serves, if, and this is, I think, one of the ways that I've looked at it, is that that number is the sort of expense of dealing with community. So, and dealing with means, you know, supporting, answering emails, doing all the sort of things that are really, really challenging, I think, for farm activity, right? But the farm really does sit, it sits in this unique position in all of our projects where, you know, generates a ton of interest from school districts, right? We've had lots of conversation around child nutrition and resiliency, and cities are interested in this, the sort of entitlement path that developers walk down where they want to do this great project and they have to give something to a, you know, an entity, a municipality or district. Farming is a fantastic tool. So you kind of get wrapped into some of those conversations. So big picture, yes, as we mature through time, the farm kind of shifts some of its activity to be more resident focused, right? In the early days, it's a little more gateway focused, right? You're trying to attract a buyer to buy a home and you're part of that process. So I've had to think of this, and we started talking to our teams about this. So we now have 3 farms that we operate. And one of the things that's really beautiful for us to see as managers of multiple farms is really we get some more pattern recognition that happens, right? And so even those our conversation at ULI is part of this. Conversations with you and other folks who do this type of work across the country help us really frame some of these conversations. One of the things I've really started to talk about is farming as a maturity model. So I think of a 0 to 1 year farm as an infant farm, right? And our expectations of infants is they need a ton of stuff, right? They need super intensive care and attention. A 1 to 2 year farm, I think of as a toddler farm. So you're starting to get some independence, right? The farm team gets a little independence. Everybody's kind of knows a little bit, you know, you see some personality come. I think of our 2 to 3 year farms as a three-nager. So when you get, you know, lots of opinions for when you get to a three-nager team. And then, you know, the 3 to 5 year is the teenager years, right? So it's like, it is very independent in lots of ways, but also requires some care. And then, you know, 5+ to me is like the young adult still growing, not fully mature, you know, needs some mentoring, but really has some kind of some space. And, so, you know, that has been for me just as a like comfort level of thinking about my organizations and where they are. And the problems they're facing and the issues they're facing has really helped me. It's not that different than, you know, we could talk about sort of animal life cycles in the same way, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great analogy. And it's very true. It takes, you know, 7 to 10 years to get a farm established to a point where it can start to kind of hum a little bit. And there's a lot of aspects to that, from soil fertility and infrastructure to systems and to customers and processes and, you know, all those things. So, you know, you hit on a couple of really important points here. And I think just to reiterate them, I mean, one is there's a lot of upfront kind of gateway value, as you put it, to building a farm in a community, in the sense that it helps get projects approved. It builds a bridge to the community. It's a major give back that has a lot of value educationally for the school system and growing food for the community and addressing a lot of the city and county goals around climate action plans or, you know, rural preservation and keeping agriculture as part of the fabric of these communities, which in many cases, these big master plan communities often do displace or just remove a lot of agricultural land and the rural character. And so there's this high level value that is, to me, very clear, but has not been clearly communicated yet in the development market. I think we can look at models like Harvest Green and Serenby and many others that have higher values because they have farms, they get better sales in general. These are the top performing communities in the country. Many of them are agrihoods. And so there's clearly, and even just getting projects approved and building that goodwill in the community, there's a lot of value that's hard to put numbers to. It's almost like invaluable. It's so valuable that it's hard to really put a number to it, but it's really important. But at the same time, you have a business to run, even if it's a nonprofit business with the HOA. If you were to kind of break it down rough percentages and give us kind of a big picture view of your budget as a whole, you know, what does that look like? What's that breakdown, roughly speaking?
Yeah, part of the challenge is with revenue right now, right? Which is why this is a great model, I think, for everybody involved, is like revenue's all over the place, right? So COVID happened and you shifted things, and we saw huge spikes in revenue. I mean, relatively speaking, from CSA membership and kind of, you know, vegetable sales on the ground. So I think we're roughly, you know, events we've targeted to try to have events be, you know, 50%, right? So whether that's community events, and most of our stuff for residents is free. It's just kind of a special if we do a special event. So we have a 1,000-person event, chef focused, you know, chef farmer focused event, which is right down the line of what we're trying to accomplish, is connect people to food. And that produces roughly, I think, 40% the past. We didn't have it last year, and, you know, it looks like this year is going to be in transition. We're trying to still nail down the date and kind of see where we are. And then CSAs kind of an increasing, so our CSA doubled, right? As soon as COVID happened, that was a significant portion. So I would say that's like roughly 20%. And then we have a unique program that's called our Farm Club. And that's for the people who are, you know, really want to be interested and want to be farming next to us, essentially. So we have a 19 by 19 plots or 18 by 18 plots on the ground that people lease, and we provide all of the support. So some of our income is another, I think, roughly 10% is related to that. And we've got some tours and stuff that, you know, kind of make up the rest of the mix. I think the miscellaneous categories.
This is a really great understanding the business model, right, of a farm in an aggregate. So
yeah.
So if you're at a roughly 50% from events, 20% from CSA, 10% from Farm Club, another 10% or so from kind of miscellaneous events, that's, what is that? That's 50, 70, 80, it's 90. So then is the HOA roughly 10%?
Well, I mean, I guess our income numbers get to 100%, whatever they are, right? So then what am I missing? So we've got events. Oh, we have markets. So farmer's market and kind of direct veggie sales, you know, weekend markets is typically, I think it's in the 10 to 20% range. So, we have a vegetable wagon where people can come and get, and this is just Harvest Green. We have vegetable wagon. People come and get produce, the weekly produce. We send out, you know, information. People like to do that. So that's an alternative to CSA. And so that's kind of the bulk of it, right? So you have, you know, I think most of the farms we've talked to across the country really do a lot more event programming than they want to. And we also feel that way in some ways, because it's really challenging, but also like that's a pretty big chunk for most folks. So, and that's typically, we see that in the 40-50% range, which is kind of what we're targeting as well.
So that's great. Tell me, as we wrap up here, maybe just a couple of like big picture takeaways from your experience so far in this work. What would you say are kind of like the biggest challenges that you come across that you would advise people who are going into this as a developer, a farm management company, a farmer, to just look out for? Like, what are the big pitfalls that you see that you would advise people to think about ahead of time?
Yeah. You know, I think of a lot of things in risk terms, right? So I think understanding the risk that everybody's taking, right? So for me as a farm operator and consultant, you know, I need to understand the risk the developer's taking, and they are taking some risk, no doubt. So then really understanding that, and then understanding sort of the benefits too, right? So there's risk, and money is often tied to risk. So the less risks involved, the less money typically is involved, right? On a reward basis. Like understanding those things. And then so much about farming has informed so much of our work, right? So I think that's the real beauty that you and I can talk about ad nauseum as well, which is like farming is about prioritization, right? It's like, it's not about perfectionism. In fact, the sort of folks who have the perfectionist tendencies, which I'll include myself slightly in that, you know, a struggle, I think more so on the farm, because it's just not possible, right? So you've got to really have your priorities in line when you're doing a project and really understand the stakeholders. So there's a lot of the human side of this. A lot of times I don't think we're actually farming. I think we're helping people grow, right? You know, it's like, it's not the direct thing that we're doing, because so many of the farm decisions are kind of one-offs or kind of wisdom decisions or whatever it is. And there's lots of good framework that you can put in place, but you don't really understand some of the emotion under it. This past year for me has been about really trying to make sure I understand our team and the emotions that they have. And if they're getting held up from a productivity standpoint, like what is the emotional context of what's happening in a broader world that's affecting them? So really paying a lot more attention to that. The prioritization of having a couple of very specific tools, either the language that we use as a team or broader team, having some, you know, one or two really specific tools that we really rely on, whether that's, you know, a simple spreadsheet about production, whether it's, you know, a simple software program, whatever it is, you know, really kind of dialing in those things so that our priorities are aligned. And so our communication's aligned, we start stacking some of these things in our efficiency. I also think one of the learnings I've had is because these projects were a little different, we didn't value the true farm experience, people that have actually had farm experience, you know, in the small scale vegetable production in the Gulf Coast or in the region that we're in. We didn't value it, I think, enough. And, you know, we certainly valued it before, but now I think we really, really have to dial in on that aspect or understanding like, hey, if we're bringing somebody in with less experience, where are we going to get them to, right? What's their progression?
Yeah.
Those are some big things. I think the other thing is like, people are rooting for this to succeed. So there is a lot of energy around the success of this. And when people have questions or criticisms, whatever it is, right? What are those questions or criticisms related to? We've had tons of failures, right? So this is, again, not perfectionism. This is about articulating where we haven't succeeded, you know, what it is we're going to do. I think everybody knows the farmer who doesn't have resources, who's driving around, you know, an extra hour or two to find a part for $5 cheaper than down the road. That's not what these projects are, right? These projects have more resources. You know, they have higher floors, but they have, you know, higher ceilings too. And so you've got to make sure that you're really understanding what it is you're doing and your resource allocation. The last thing I guess I would say is like managing people and farmers is both an on the ground experience. So like being there with them, understanding what they're talking about, and you need to have some big picture stuff, right? You need to be able to step away. And I think every farmer probably relates to the sort of the thing that you love the most also can bring you the most pain, the stress of farming and seeing a hard freeze and your plant babies that you've loved and cared for and nurtured, totally devastated. And also sort of the attitude of like, all right, we got to, you know, pick it up, move on, got to move it forward. So, you know, I think those are the big lessons, I would say.
We've talked together about writing some kind of a manual for this.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about it for years and years because there's so many little things, the details, you know, there's SOPs around farming and production and fertility management and animal husbandry and food safety. And then there's also all these things around like programming and events and staffing, and you're managing a complex enterprise. It's really a nonprofit social enterprise that is interfacing with so many stakeholders, as you mentioned, the community, the developer, the HOA, the broader community. This is not just like a, you know, scratch some soil, plant some seeds, grow some food situation. This is about building, this is a community enterprise that has a lot of different elements to it. And so not only is it a farm, and not only is it a business, but it's also an amenity. It's also part of a community. And anyone who has any experience with HOAs and communities knows,
right,
you know, they kind of roll their eyes, right? It's like, oh God. So what I think is really exciting about this is, and what I love about having this podcast and having these relationships with so many projects and people like yourself that are living it every day, is there's so many things that we're learning together. And as a field, as a movement, you know, we're just getting better every day. And I think if we can share these experiences and work together to figure out, you know, it's not a one size fits all model. Like you said, there's projects from 300 homes to 30,000 homes and everything in between. And in all these different, you know, regions and climates, and, you know, every project really does need to be looked at through, you know, its own specific lens. And there's a lot of lessons and approaches and experiences that we can share as a field that can apply to these projects. But at the end of the day, right, if we can just integrate food production and a connection for people in a community to the land, to their food, and to each other, and create more resilient communities that have that kind of exposure and connection, I really think that, you know, when you zoom out of the day-to-day weeds and you look at the big picture and you go, this is, in theory, this is a simple idea that should be simple to execute. And, you know, the more simple we can make it, the better, so that it's scalable and replicable and doable, you know, the better off we're going to be as a society. And so I'm excited to continue to collaborate with you and the others that we've been working with through this field building work to just continue to share these experiences and hopefully get together again soon and strengthen the relationships that we have with each other and continue to build the momentum for this kind of work that we really need. People are really hungry, literally hungry, but also spiritually hungry for this kind of experience and connection. And so I applaud you and your perseverance and ambition to continue to pursue this work. And I'm here to help however I can. To close it out, maybe just share how people can follow you guys so they can stay connected with Agmenity.
Yeah, I appreciate the kind words and in the kind spirit, you know, of connection and support. You've been both of those things for years now. The best way to reach out to us, because we're often at projects, is by email or connecting to our website. So Agmenity is our website, agmenity.com. It's an agricultural amenity. You can see we smash those two words together. If you need me, my name's Clayton. You can reach me, Clayton@agmenity.com. That's my email. And, you know, appreciate any thoughts or feedback folks have. And I look forward to continuing this movement. And hopefully we get that manual out, you know, maybe another citizen farmer book that can help help move us forward too, right?
Absolutely.
So appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate you, man. Have a great one. All the best.
Thanks, Darren. Likewise.
Join the Citizen Farmers community. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook. For more information, check out today's show notes. This podcast is co-produced by Ben Bernstein. Our audio editor is Sarah Milligan. Thanks for listening to Season 2 of the Citizen Farmers Podcast, where we are reimagining community to create a healthier, more connected world.
Do you care about the health of people and the planet? Connect with the Citizen Farmers Movement to grow healthy food, build your community, and give back to the earth through actions big or small. Follow us on Instagram or sign up for our newsletter at citizenfarmers.org. To learn more about our work at Farmer D, designing and building vibrant farm-based communities, visit us at farmerd.com. Thanks for listening.